This is VOA News. I'm Faith Lapidus. U.S. President Donald Trump on Sunday assailed Congressman Justin Amash as a total lightweight after the Michigan lawmaker became the first Republican to call for Trump's impeachment. Trump called Amash a loser who sadly plays right into our opponent's hands. Amash, echoing numerous Democratic lawmakers, claimed that Trump engaged in impeachable conduct by attempting to obstruct Special Counsel Robert Mueller's investigation into Russian meddling in the 2016 presidential election. Reuters correspondent Jason Albano reports.
U.S. Representative Justin Amash took to Twitter on Saturday, saying that Special Counsel Robert Mueller's report on the investigation into Russian interference in the 2016 election revealed that Trump, quote, engaged in specific actions and a pattern of behavior that meet the threshold for impeachment. Amash also said the report, quote, identifies multiple examples of conduct satisfying all the elements of obstruction of justice. The White House and the Department of Justice did not immediately respond to requests for comments about Amash's tweets.
Our attorney general ruled based on the information there was no obstruction. So you have no collusion, no obstruction.
While Trump has said that the report concluded there was no obstruction of justice, the report made no formal finding, leaving it to Congress to decide.
Reuters' Jason Albano. At least 16 people were injured in a blast targeting a bus near Egypt's Giza Pyramid Sunday, according to security sources. Officials said the bus was carrying 25 people, most of them South African tourists. Videos circulating online show the bus windows blown out or shattered. There was no immediate claim of responsibility for the blast. In December, three Vietnamese tourists and one Egyptian guide were killed when a bomb hit their bus near the Giza Pyramids. This is VOA News. Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi will secure a second term in office, according to exit polls announced after the country's mammoth general election wrapped up on Sunday. Five different polls said the BJP was set to win 287 to 305 seats, comfortably crossing the halfway mark in the 545-member parliament. Sunday's vote wraps up an unusually vitriolic campaign that virtually turned into a referendum on Prime Minister Modi, according to political analyst Nilanjan Mukhopadhyay.
This was a recurring theme that he alone is the Lord Protector of India and Indians. That is what came across very strongly. In this campaign, Hindutva agenda was at the forefront. The deliveries of the government, they were not the primary showcases.
U.S. President Donald Trump says he is less restrictive in his anti-abortion views than provisions in a string of pro-life laws being adopted by conservative state legislatures in recent days. Trump, in a late Saturday Twitter remark, described himself as strongly pro-life, but said abortions were acceptable in cases of rape or incest or when the mother's life is in danger. 20 years ago, long before entering politics, Trump described himself as very pro-choice, leaving the decision of whether to have an abortion up to a woman. Iraq called ExxonMobil's decision to evacuate all its staff from the oil-rich country unacceptable and unjustified. Sunday's statement comes days after the U.S. pulled non-emergency staff members from its embassy in Baghdad, apparently due to concerns over perceived threats from neighboring Iran. The oil ministry said the company's actions had nothing to do with security in southern Iraqi oil fields or any threats, adding the reasons are political. Taliban and American military officials have taken to social media to accuse each other of acting against peace-building efforts in conflict-torn Afghanistan. The sparring via Twitter comes as the two sides are engaged in a months-long dialogue to try to bring an end to the Afghan war. But talks have failed to deter the Taliban from stopping or reducing hostilities. Recent battles between Taliban insurgents and U.S.-backed Afghan forces have killed and wounded hundreds of people. Dutch singer-songwriter Duncan Lawrence has won the 64th Eurovision Song Contest in Israel Sunday with his piano ballad, Arcade. His victory gives the Netherlands the right to host the 2020 finals. I'm Faith Lapidus, VOA News.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clawton in Washington.
We have all the hope that all Ugandans are going to rise up and demand for government to fulfill its obligations. And we do believe this is going to be a different story altogether.
Ugandan teachers to embark on a nationwide strike action Monday.
We are saying we want freedom now. That freedom might come before 2021. We might use that election in the unlikely event that we run into 2021 before defeating the junta. We shall go into that election by defiance.
A Ugandan opposition parliamentarian meets U.S. officials over the current political situation in the East African country.
I'm Congolese. I was born in Congo. I grown up in Congo. My mother, she was Congolese. So I think what is important today is to see the positive things.
And Moise Katumbi, a Democratic Republic of Congo opposition leader, plans to return home Monday. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. General Secretary of the Ugandan National Teachers Union says members of the group will embark on a nationwide strike Monday. Philbert Baguma says the strike is necessary to pressure the government to keep its part of the agreement to increase salaries of teachers and that of public sector workers. It came after the group issued a 90-day ultimatum to hear favorably from the government, but the ultimatum has since expired with no word from the administration. For more about their demand for increased pay, I reach Philbert Baguma, General Secretary of the Ugandan National Teachers Union.
Uganda National Teachers Union has been negotiating with the government over salary increments. And last year, 2018, on the 22nd of June, we agreed with the government and signed the collective bargaining agreement detailing what the teachers were supposed to get come this year, beginning July. Government have since backtracked and has not implemented what we agreed on in next year's financial year. The budget is about to be completed in this month, and therefore that's the cause of our industrial action, which is going to begin on Monday 20th. In February on 19th, we gave government a 90-day notice as provided for by the law. And the government has not responded, and therefore we shall use the language they listen to.
So what specific increase are you seeking? Because obviously the government has said previously in your negotiations that there are no funds to meet those obligations.
Yes, you know the teachers are in different scales. We have got teachers in U7, teachers in U4, teachers in U6. Teachers in U2, U3, and so on. And therefore, these have got different salaries depending on their scales. So what we had agreed on with the government was according to those scales, and we agreed on figures. The collective bargaining agreement we agreed on has been partially implemented in amongst other civil servants. It is only the teachers who have not benefited and other civil servants from other departments. And therefore, this is not only for the teachers, but also other civil servants as well.
Do you think your strike action Monday would have any impact on the administration? Because you know that some of these strike action or demonstrations have not yielded any positive fruit. What is going to be different from this demonstration that you want to embark on Monday?
This is not an issue of teachers alone. It is an issue of teachers. It is an issue of learners. It is an issue of all Ugandans, where we have got government which sits down and agrees, puts everything in writing on a paper in black and white, and the next day it is backtracking. Therefore, we have all the hope that all Ugandans are going to rise up and demand for government to fulfill its obligation. And we do believe this is going to be a different story altogether.
Well, but Mr. Baguma, supporters of the NRM, the ruling party, are saying that this demonstration is tinged with political calculations just to make the ruling party unpopular, instead of continuing or engaging with the government to try to find an amicable solution, instead of going on demonstration just to create a political publicity stunt just to make the government unpopular.
If anything, the representatives of government who are betraying the cause of public service unions are the ones working for the opposition. If we were working for opposition, then we wouldn't have invested all the time we invested last year from the month of February up to June. All that time was spent when we were negotiating and we came to an agreement. So if we came to an agreement and the government is not committed to fulfilling its agreement, who is betraying who?
Philbert Baguma is the General Secretary of the Ugandan National Teachers Union. He spoke with me from the capital, Kampala. Betty Nambuzi Bakiriki is a Ugandan opposition lawmaker who was attacked on the floor of parliament, which left her spinal cord broken. Local media reports say the attackers are state security operatives who were deployed to parliament on suspicion that opposition parliamentarians would create chaos. Opposition and civil society groups demand the prosecution of the masterminds and the attackers, but the administration has yet to take action. Ms. Nambuzi Bakiriki is currently in Washington, D.C., where she met with U.S. officials. She stopped by the VOA studios here in Washington, where I caught up with her and began by asking about the political situation in Uganda.
What we have in Uganda today is a military dictatorship, but wisely dressed in clothes that give it a picture from a distance. If you are looking at Uganda from a distance, you can easily mistake it for a democracy. Spearheaded by a sophisticated man, not the type of the Mobutus, the Aminis, first dictators of the independent African countries.
But how are they able to rig them if the people don't stop it? Because a lot of opposition people say that the government or the NRM keeps rigging elections. But the power resides with the people.
In theory, yes. Ours is still a civically incompetent population. It is just because of the history of the country. We are a young country. This country was brought together in 1962. Basically, we are still even negotiating the very existence of the country. Nothing much unites the people of Uganda. People would prefer to look at themselves in their small tribes. So what we have now is an artificial state, almost leadership and governance imposed on the people. So yes, we have a constitution that provides for the fact that power belongs to the people, but that is only in ink. Opposition. People are so weak, they don't wield their power, and the struggle we are spearheading right now is to return power to the people.
How do you intend doing that? When President Museveni and the NRM are saying that power already belongs to the people, and the people have been voting them into power?
Well, what we are working on at the moment is to give ourselves a transitional government where we will renegotiate the existence of Uganda.
But how would you have a transitional government when a legitimate government has been elected? The African Union really sees him as the president. The international community sees him as a duly elected.
How I wish that we would not even refer to recognitions by the African Union. They can recognize anybody. They did recognize Idi Amin. He was even a chairman of the OAU. So this is just a club of this people with almost the same characteristics, except for few countries on the continent.
I understand that. So, there is a case where in Burkina Faso,
yes,
people prevented former President Blaise Compaoré from amending the constitution again. And
we congratulate them, and those are very good examples.
You
for
have
Uganda.
Another one in the Gambia where He lost an election. He decided to stay. West Africa said, no, you can't do that. They pushed him out. What is preventing the people of Uganda from replicating this example if indeed Mr. Museveni is as unpopular as you say?
We are looking at these countries as a good examples to us, and Ugandans have taken great interest in the affairs of such countries. Very soon you will hear from us in Uganda, and I tell you that will be very soon. Ugandans, especially now the youth, are getting more aggressive and more assertive. That's why you see that we have now new youth movements coming up like the People Power. And of course, Mr. Museveni is using the army against the population. So far, we have not been able to convince the army to be on our side. But when it comes to the general population, Uganda is already decided.
So where do you see Uganda within the next 5 years or before the next general election? Do you think Uganda would have elections the next time around?
Well, all the signs are that Mr. Museveni is not going to deliver to us a free and fair election. We are saying we can't start organizing for 2021 elections when we haven't secured it today. So what we are doing as opposition is, first of all, to come together to fight for our freedom, our space right now. We don't want to be diverted by a promise of an election in 2021. We are saying we want freedom now. That freedom might come before 2021. We might use that election in the unlikely event that we run into 2021 before defeating the junta. We shall go into that election by defiance.
Betty Nambozi Bakirike is a Ugandan opposition parliamentarian. She spoke with me from here in Washington, D.C. Moise Katumbi, a prominent opposition leader in the Democratic Republic of Congo, plans to return home Monday. His return follows a decision by an appeals court to dismiss a 3-year prison sentence. Katumbi, a former governor of the Katanga province, was disqualified from participating in the recent 2018 presidential election over dual citizenship concerns. For more about his political plans on his return to the DRC, VOA's French to Africa reporter Raissa Girondin reached Moise Katumbi in the Belgian capital, Brussels.
He was forced to come in exile. Today, I'm returning 3 years later.
You've just taken the rotating presidency of Lamuka platform. What role do you think you can play to help this new government?
What is important for me, your opposition as Lamuka, is to have a Republican opposition, constructive opposition. I'm going to the country to say thank you to the Congolese people who fought not to have the third mandate for President Kabila, and at least to see for our country the great future for the people of Congo.
But, Mr. Katumbi, when we see that Martin Fayulu, an active member of Lamuka, continues to ask the true poll result, can you clarify your position?
We came out from Lamuka as an electoral platform. Had our meeting with my brother Martin, my brother Jean-Pierre Bemba, and the other brothers, Professor Matungulu and Muzito from Lamuka. We changed our vision to say, let's become a political platform to see the future for our country. What is important for us today is the future of the Congolese people, and we can develop the country together.
What are your plans returning home, and why you think your return is all significant to any Congolese?
I was in exile. I was living better than the people in my country. Where they are living, plenty of people have died, what and what. I'm going there first to be with them, to stay with them, and to say thank you because they defended me when they created all this nonsense with fake cases. So I'm going as a man of peace. I ask everyone to wear white clothes. If they don't have a white clothes, to have a white small flag.
Currently, what are you the most concerned about in DRC?
Ebola disease, which is in Congo, is killing a lot of people. I'm telling the people of Congo, let's fight together. You can't fight Ebola disease with the witch doctor. We have to fight scientifically with the doctors to eradicate Ebola. And I'm calling the international community. 1,000 people have died with Ebola. Please, please, let's come together to finish this disease in our country.
Your conviction has been annulled and you got your passport back. Hence why you can return now to the country as a free man. Can we say that Félix Tshisekedi's rise to power made it easier for you to come back?
You see, every citizen of Congo is entitled to have his passport. Not giving him a passport is a crime like what they did to me. I'm Congolese. I was born in Congo. I grown up in Congo. My mother, she was Congolese. So I think what is important today is to see the positive things. Today, my brother Martin can go left and right doing meetings. They don't shoot on the people. There is free speech today in the country. We have to see what positive President Tshisekedi is doing. And we are going there. If something is wrong, we are going to tell him, Mr. President, this is not the way. So we need very constructive opposition. We don't need any more suffering in the country. I think today President Tshisekedi have released the people in prison, political prisoners. Before, if you go and do the meeting, you're supposed to find yourself in the graveyard. You're supposed to find yourself in jail or in the Congo River. So all these things are finished.
Moise Katumbi is an opposition leader in the Democratic Republic of Congo. He spoke with VOA's French to Africa reporter Raissa Girondin from Brussels. A UN watchdog group is demanding an end to the widespread practice of torture and other cruel punishments in the Democratic Republic of Congo. The DRC is one of six countries examined by the UN Committee Against Torture, which monitors the implementation by states of the Convention Against Torture. At the conclusion of its four-week session, the committee criticized the DRC for failing to meet this test. For VOA, Lisa Schlein has more from Geneva.
Democratic Republic of Congo's Minister for Human Rights, Marie-Ange Mushabekwa, offered a vigorous defense of her country's efforts to comply with the provisions of the Convention Against Torture. She argued that following the ratification of the treaty in 2010, her country had adopted a law against torture, which strengthened and completed the penal code. She said measures were being enacted to strengthen the criminalization of torture. But her defense failed to persuade the 18 independent members of the UN Committee Against Torture. Human rights expert Sebastian Touze says evidence presented to the committee indicates the prohibitions enshrined in the convention are being completely ignored by the DRC, legally and in practice. Furthermore, he notes 63% of human rights violations were committed by state agents.
Il en ressort dès lors un sentiment et un climat général d'impunité, c'est-à-dire qu'il n'y a aucune poursuite qui sont ouvertes contre.
He says there is a general climate of impunity in DRC. He says no one suspected of human rights violations is prosecuted, allowing torture and other cruel acts to flourish. He says victims of abuse are abandoned and have no recourse to justice. In its report, the committee notes that arbitrary detention is widespread. It finds secret detention centers continue to exist, in which the majority of detainees there are victims of torture and cruel and degrading treatment. Those most at risk of abuse, it says, include human rights defenders, journalists, and political dissidents. The UN Committee reports violence against women is widespread. And while rape and sexual violence, including mass rape, are endemic in situations of conflict, it says the 2011 law in DRC does not recognize these atrocities as acts of torture. The experts express great concern about the numerous human rights violations received by the committee. They have asked the DRC delegation to report back within a year on steps being taken to bring the country into compliance with the torture convention. Minister Mushabekwa said her country was not in denial about its checkered human rights record. She said the government is doing all it can to fight impunity against torture, but things take time. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The Burundian government has announced properties belonging to a list of people to be seized. The list issued by the Prosecutor General Sylvestre Nyamdwi includes opponents and critics of President Pierre Nkurunziza. They are accused of supporting the attempt to overthrow Nkurunziza's administration. Opponents say the Arusha agreement allows Nkurunziza to serve only two terms in office, an assertion the government denies. For more on the order to seize properties belonging to critics, including journalists, civil society activists, and opponents abroad, I read Vital Nshimirimana, the Burundian leader of the Group for the Strengthening of Civil Society. He is named on the list.
That is really a shame for the Burundian justice because it is in a total breach of all the fundamental human rights and the principles, the basic principles of a criminal law.
What does that mean? Because doesn't the Constitution give the Justice Minister to make such a pronouncement, particularly when people have attempted to overthrow President Pierre Nkurunziza's government?
Yeah, basically, the overthrowing the Burundian regime in 2015 has been a pretense for the regime to actually persecute all the opposition leaders, civil society leaders, journalists, and all the persons that oppose the third term of Pierre Nkurunziza. And there's nothing of a criminal procedure in such.
Officials of the government disagree with that, that there's no pretense here, that people were apprehended with far advanced plot to overthrow the government. There were people who were arrested with evidence. Why do you think this is a pretense by the government?
Yeah, well, there are some officials, by the way, there are some generals who are who were arrested and now they are jailed, and they have even been sentenced. But the way they have been sentenced and the way they have been explaining was that they tried to arrest the violation of human rights against the peaceful protesters that were opposing the third term of Pierre Nkurunziza. That was their explanation. But there are other people who have never been in that plan, including those in the civil society, journalists, and other opposition leaders. So taking all the groups, all these people, and bringing them in those who planned the coup is actually a very fake thing.
But Vital, your name was one of many among the list issued by the government. Some say those on the list, including yourself, have their properties seized. What is your next line of action looking at your name being on the list?
No, no, well, the government of Burundi have been doing many awful plans against me and others. Look, in 2017, the government of Burundi decided to disbar me and the other lawyers from the bar illegally. And that they have been accusing us of all the crimes that we didn't commit. And we have been in the leading group that opposed the third term of Pierre Nkurunziza, and we assume this is the thing that we historically agree that we played a role in defending the constitution of Burundi. But our interpretation now is Nkurunziza is trying to send a message to those who would attempt to oppose his fourth, now he's planning for the fourth term, that should any people or groups attempt to oppose the fourth term of Nkurunziza, that their properties will be seized. That is the message.
But isn't it the case that some of you who claim that you are defending the Constitution equally supported the coup to overthrow his administration because you were opposed to his attempt to seek re-election for his third consecutive time, which the government denies is the case in the first place?
No, by the way, if our peaceful protests went on until sometimes in July or August, we would have succeeded a revolution as those in Burkina Faso, in Algeria, or in Sudan. But because of the unfortunate coup, our movement was actually stopped. What we wanted was actually to bring Burundians to the respect of the constitution and the Arusha peace agreement. That was our plan, and it is still being the way we are dealing with the crisis.
Vital Nshimirimana is the Burundian leader of the Group for the Strengthening of Civil Society. He spoke with me from Brussels. This is The Voice of America, and you're listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington, coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa Sports with Douglas Impuga and music from our African collection. And that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. But first, a delegation from the Kenyan military is sharing experience on how the Cameroon Military Engineering Corps has taken over road construction projects in Boko Haram terrorism-prone areas to use the example and develop areas of its territory threatened by Al-Shabaab, which they say is still a threat. The Kenyan delegation has been in Cameroon for several days. For VOA, Moki Edwin Kenzaka reports from the Cameroonian capital, Yaoundé.
This is a Cameroon Military Engineering Corps compactor constructing a portion of the road linking its northern border town of Kuseri to the Chadian capital N'Djamena and Borno State in northeastern Nigeria. Colonel Jackson Kamgan, director of Cameroon Military Engineering Corps, says they relaunched the World Bank-sponsored project in March 2018 after it had been abandoned for 4 years.
Dans la plupart de nos pays, le génie militaire est exclusivement consacré aux activités liées à la guerre.
He says, since independence in 1961, the Cameroon Military Engineering Corps has participated actively in the development of all localities and ensures that major projects in conflict zones are not abandoned, unlike in many other countries where military engineering departments concentrate only on making access easy for troops in areas of war or conflict. The road project was interrupted in 2014 following an assault on the base camp of the Chinese road contractors, in which 10 of their workers were kidnapped by suspected Boko Haram rebels. The kidnappers also stole 10 vehicles and a container of explosives. The workers escaped, but road construction companies refused to resume work there for fear of the terrorists. The government of Cameroon convinced project funders that its military engineering corps could construct the road even while the war against Boko Haram was raging. The World Bank provided about $125 million for the project, which is to be completed in 24 months. General Mohamed Ali, governor of Kenya's Marsabit region and head of the 17-man Kenyan delegation of military and officials from the Ministry of Transport, says they came to Cameroon to learn from the Central African state's experience.
The military was challenged with a very, very unique situation, which is not really very normally in their line of duty because of serious level of insecurity, where contractors have not been able to show any interest to undertake major construction work in the area infested by Boko Haram. They showed leadership and undertook that serious national project.
Ali said the Kenyan government's plan to link the country with Somalia by constructing a link road to increase trade between the two countries has been facing threats from the Al-Qaeda-linked Al-Shabaab insurgency. In April 2019, the International Crisis Group reported that since 2015, Al-Shabaab has conducted over 100 small-scale assaults in the northeast of Kenya, killing dozens of soldiers and police, mostly with roadside bombs. Kenyan General James Gitiba, who was also in Cameroon, says African militaries will contribute more to reducing pain and suffering in the continent's several conflict zones if they also embrace development initiatives
that go beyond simply fighting enemies.
Most militaries in Africa are known for the very basic function of enhancement of mobility, which is basically clearing a route for the troops to pass, and also survivability. So for Cameroon, this is a milestone, and I think I could also urge other friendly countries to come here and learn.
Soldiers from Cameroon, Nigeria, Chad, and Niger, part of the multinational joint task force of the Lake Chad Basin Commission, have been fighting Boko Haram terrorism that began in northeastern Nigeria 9 years ago and has left 25,000 people dead and forced more than 2.6 million others to flee their homes, according to the United Nations. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
And it's now time for Nightline Africa Sports. And for that, let's join Douglas Mpunga. Hello, Douglas.
Hi, Peter. Good evening, sports fans. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports. We are nearing the start of the 2019 Women's World Cup, which gets underway in France on June 7th and features the 24 teams vying for the title. Africa will be represented by Nigeria, South Africa, and Cameroon. South Africa coach Desiree Ellis named her Women's World Cup squad late last week. She left out veteran midfielder Mpuni Nyandeni, but included 18-year-old Sibilele Holweni. The 31-year-old Nyandeni, who had been part of the Banyana Banyana setup since making her debut in 2001, played at the 2012 and 2016 Olympic Games, winning over 100 caps in the process. Banyana Banyana have been handed a tough draw for the debut at a World Cup and begin their campaign in France on June 8th against Spain before facing China and finally Germany. Nigeria is in Group A with hosts France, Korean Republic and Norway. The other African team, Cameroon, is in Group E with Netherlands, Canada and New Zealand. Meanwhile, three African players won the English Premier League Golden Boot. Senegalese Sadio Mane of Liverpool and Gabonese Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang of Arsenal scored final day goals to share the golden boot with Egypt's Mohamed Salah, also of Liverpool. The three scored 22 goals each. Salah won the prize last season. The 26-year-old scored 32 goals last term. That figure is the record for the most goals scored in a 38-game campaign. He becomes the sixth player to win the award in consecutive seasons. In athletics, defending champion Geoffrey Kirui and two-time world champion Edna Kiplagat are among the athletes named by Athletics Kenya for the marathon at World Athletics Championships Doha 2019. Nine athletes have been selected, but two of those will be reserves. As Kirui gets a wild card entry by virtue of being the defending champion, Kenya will have four men on the marathon start line and three women. The final lineup will be decided nearer to the time of the World Championships. Kirui, who also won the Boston Marathon in 2017, is joined on the team by Amos Kipruto, Laban Korir, Paul Lonyangata, and Ernest Ngeno. Kipruto, a 2:05.43 performer, finished on the podium in Tokyo and Berlin last year. Korir, a former winner in Toronto, has a personal best of 2 hours, 5 minutes and 54 seconds. Lonyangata set his personal best of 2:06.10 in 2007, the first of his two Paris Marathon victories. Ngeno has reached the podium in 9 of his 11 marathons to date, clocking a personal best of 2:06.41 last year. Kiplagat is joined on the Kenyan World Championships team by Ruth Chengetich, Sale Chipiego, and Veselin Chipkesho. Chengetich won in Istanbul last year and then took the Dubai Marathon title earlier this year, moving to third on the world all-time list. Chipiego earned the bronze medal at the 2014 World Half Marathon Championships and set a marathon personal best of 2:23.15 last year. Chipkesho, a former winner in Paris and Rotterdam, has a personal best of 2:21.37. And that's about it for this edition of Netland Africa Sports. Now back to you, Peter.
Thanks a lot, Douglas. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African Sports Nightline, Africa Sports.
And it's Sunday on Nightline Africa. This is the time we get to relax and reflect, a flashback with music from the continent. And you are hearing See Me and Praise with Out of My Mind. Willie Paul featuring Ray Vani with follows. Then Yemi Alade featuring Slim Keys. Branny Come Your Way with Yaji. And then we end with Techno Miles with Where.
Manyama kwenye sambusa, kichuguni mzigo na toroli, adi nguo inataka pasuka, msupu mwenye macho ya goroi, rangi kama unaoga mafuta. Oh my, oh my, I don't lie, guy know you change my life. In your eyes, I don't lie, guy know you change my life. When do I do the abaya, sikia usijani kimbia tulia mile niwe na wewe.
Girls go bum bum, shaking, shaking your bum bum bum, liking your package, feeling the package, making the boys boom on.
Make me the way body, 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 body
kusi. Gududum 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 gududum. Baby dance, dance, baby shake, shake, yeah. Allah hati takino. Hallelujah, Hosanna, girl, you I want to. Get your body banana sweet in my heart.
Sunday Music Spot. Hope you enjoy the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of the Voice of America in Washington. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict in time of peace. Here's one man's point of view with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Hello, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. The African continent cannot ignore crucial developments in the global community, even when those developments have not yet impacted on the African continent. That lesson was taught to the world by the late Emperor of Ethiopia, Selassie, in the waning days of the League of Nations and the beginning of the Second World War. With his country under Italian occupation, Selassie had gone to the Assembly of the League of Nations to warn the European countries that peace was indivisible, meaning that they could not buy peace in Europe by appeasement of dictators while sacrificing his country to occupation by Mussolini of Italy. Similarly, now we see in the world developments which may or may not impact us in Africa, and yet African leaders are ignoring it. This was reversed last week when Facebook announced in a dramatic way that it had deleted a number of postings by an Israeli firm that were aimed at affecting elections in a number of African countries. In many ways, Facebook was vague and did not give specifics, so there would be a need to obtain from Facebook specifics about the African countries concerned and as to who was sponsoring these postings. Perhaps this is a task that should be assigned to the African Union. But we must bear in mind the rule of free and fair elections. Prior to that, there were civil conflicts in Africa because many African states, they could not agree as to who should rule. And failure to agree cost human lives in many African countries. Free and fair elections was the only practical way to resolve that issue. What will happen then if we return to a situation where African people could have no confidence in the legitimacy of elections? So what we should do now is to try to see how best the African continent could tackle this troublesome issue. Because in Europe and other countries where there have been charges and countercharges about foreign governments interfering in their elections, they have been going to do things to counter these interferences. And in some cases, it has caused lots and lots of money, and they do have the capabilities, yet they are not sure whether they are successful. Africa does not have the capability to do these things. So we have to find a way to be able to deal with this problem. The first thing that Africans should do is to have this recognition and to announce that it could not by itself do it. And one thing they could do is that the African group at the United Nations should propose an agenda item for the next session of the General Assembly that will be entitled Preventing Foreign Entity Interference in the Election of Member States. It will be a controversial agenda item, but Africa has no choice. It is like when the issue of terrorism emerged in the UN after the Munich Olympics. So Africa should push that and then begin to deal with this issue. Failure to do so will be catastrophic for the African continent. We have to see whether the Facebook can also contribute to what is happening in the case of the Israeli firm. When did they discover it? Why is it only now being disclosed? These are all issues which can be very helpful to the African continent. But what we cannot do is failure to act. Because if we don't act, then Africa is looking for a very bleak future insofar as free and fair elections are concerned. I thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Hope you enjoyed the program tonight. As you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, managing editor Shaka Sala, reporter Douglas Mpuga, producer Saida Hamdun, and our engineer for today, Xiao Gang Chang, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, water has an insipid taste and colorless, but you can live on it longer than eating food. I'm your host, Peter Clotin, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.